Today, the greater discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint. And this one particularly appropriate, because in the last few days we've been doing some discussing of global warming and the rather apocalyptic messages which have been sent through the what are normally very staid academic journals. And we've got this kind of information which is sort of presented in a way which is, of course, as convoluted and confusing and technical as possible, but the end result of it is that we're all going to die, if you know what I mean. Yeah, so, and that the world's going to come to an end, more or less. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but not too much of one. So, this is a sutta which deals with exactly those kinds of things. So this discourse has only one, apparently only one existing parallel version, which is Majjhima Agama 30. Right, okay, so this one is a detailed inquiry into the Four Noble Truths, and Venerable Sariputta being the teacher here, and again using the simile of the elephant's footprint that we heard last week. Or last lesson, and Venerable Nanalia notes that there's a number of other suttas in the Sanyutta and Anguttara also, which report the Buddha using the elephant's footprint to embrace the footprints of all other animals, and this highlights the importance of diligence and sometimes also of wisdom. So this is a little bit unusual as a beginning of a sutta, because here Sariputta just kind of sits down and says, "Okay, bhikkhus, I'm going to tell you how it is." And this is quite unusual in the suttas. Usually, when the disciples give a discourse, they almost invariably give it in terms of a question and answer session with the monks or with the Buddha or something like that. And so this is one of the very, very few suttas where the disciple actually gives a direct discourse, much in the way that the Buddha would. Remember, I talked a few lessons ago about the nine angas, and the sutta anga being the direct declarative discourses, which are almost always spoken by the Buddha himself, and the vyakaranas being those in question and answer session, which is spoken often by the disciple. But what we see in this kind of sutta, the disciple, this is obviously a vyakarana kind of discourse, even though formally it's not in question and answer format. But it frequently quotes from the suttas, and we see throughout here that Venerable Sariputta is very often quoting from the discourses, as he does elsewhere, for example in the Samadhi Sutta or the Satta Vibhanga Sutta, which are similar in being kind of lengthy analytical discourses, where Sariputta bases his teaching very closely on the main teaching categories which are found primarily in the Sanyutta Nikaya. Friends, just as the footprint of any living being that walks can be placed within an elephant's footprint, so the elephant's footprint is declared the chief of them because of its great size. So too, all wholesome dhammas can be included within the Four Noble Truths. What for? The noble truth of suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So notice this word here. Included, sangahang, and sangahang included, but this became one of the standard technical terms for the Abhidhamma, and so the Abhidhamma has a sangahang. A sangahang is one of the basic means of analysis, and what it means is included and not included, so that it's basically like a set of Venn diagrams where you can sort of describe what is included and what is not included with any particular category. And so you can say this particular term embraces such and such and such and such and excludes such and such and such and such. And so when the various dhammas of the Abhidhamma are analyzed systematically in this way, this section is called the Sangaha section, the inclusion section. And this just to recognize the links between the teachings, especially of Venerable Sariputta and the development of the Abhidhamma systemized systems. Okay, so here we go. Right, the Four Noble Truths, right? 1, 2, 3, 4. starting with dukkha ariyasaccha. And so then he goes on to explain what is dukkha ariyasaccha. So taking the first one of these and then explaining it in more detail. Jatipi dukkha, generation is birth. You learned before, jati related to the English word generation. Jarapi, geriatric. Being geriatric is dukkha. Maranampi, being mortal, is dukkha. Soka parideva dukkha domanas upayasapi, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. A dukkha. Yampi chang nalabhati tampi dukkhang. Not getting what you want is dukkha, which is why abbots use this as a lesson very often. I want to teach you what the nature of suffering is. Sankhitena panchupadana kandho, should be kandha, not kandho in this print. Kandha dukkha. So, in brief, the five aggregates affected by grasping are dukkha. And so here we have this term we talked about the last time. Five upadana, grasping khandhas. Okay, so grasping like a hand, the thumb and the four fingers, grasping like that. We just uncovered yesterday an essay done by Venerable Bodhi during the 1970s where he investigated the relationship between the khanda and the upadana khanda. And so if anybody's interested what's the difference between khanda and upadana khanda, then have a look at Venerable Bodhi's essay. Okay, so now, so having started off with the four noble truths, he then picks up the first noble truth, the truth of dukkha. Then from the truth of dukkha, he picks up the panchupadana khandha. Here again it has khandho as a singular ending here. Which must be a characteristic of this particular Burmese manuscript. Okay, gatame chavaso panchupadana khandho, should be khandha. Seyatidang rupupadana khandho, physical form. Vedana, sanya, sankhara, vijnana, okay? So the five aggregates. So he's like, he's just going further and further in. He's going, taking one particular bit and then taking it further and further in. If he went through the whole detail of all of them, then this would be, it'd take up the whole Dhamma. Like, this is effectively what the Abhidhamma does. Whereas he sort of outlines the whole system and then goes into one thing further and further and keeps expanding it. Now, if you were to say, well, I'm going to do the same thing for everything, for all the Four Noble Truths and all the items in the Four Noble Truths and analyze them all to the same level of detail, then you'd end up with something like the Vibhanga of the Abhidhamma or something like that. So this is what they did. But here he's only choosing part of it. And so now he's gone into the first of the five aggregates, so the Four Noble Truths, and then from there to the First Noble Truth, and then to the five khandhas as part of the First Noble Truth, and then to the Rupupadana khanda, the physical form. Chatari cha mahabhutani, chatunnan cha mahabhutanang upadaya rupang. So this is the classic definition of physical form. There's a few others, but this is one of the classic ones. The four great bhutas, so they're usually translated as elements, okay? But the word bhuta means what has come to be, what has been produced, okay? Mahabhuta. Chatunnancha mahabhutanang upadaya rupang. And this is a somewhat cryptic phrase. What it means is the rupa, which is arisen, dependent, so it's upadaya means arisen dependent, on the four great elements. Okay? So that whatever form there is, it's arisen dependent on the four. So what exactly is that? So the suttas never explicitly and clearly say what that is, and so we're left a bit to speculate. The Abhidhamma, of course, spells it out in detail, but this particular sutta does give us a little bit of a hint as to what it might be. Okay, so perhaps it means dark matter, quarks. Did the Buddha know about theoretical physics? Sorry.
Doesn't he say that it's dependent on the fire, air, water, and
talking
about it, so you say it doesn't spell it out. So which part doesn't it
spell it out? Well, what is dependent on those four,
yeah,
but what actually is it?
Oh, derived the body. From... What is the body?
No, is it the body? He doesn't say, he's not saying it's the body here.
I thought it was rupa, physical.
Rupa, yeah, but rupa doesn't necessarily mean the body. Sometimes it does. But it can be broader than that as well. So, for example, rupa also includes, say, the objects of the senses. Uh-huh. Right? This is also rupa. Yeah? But you're quite right. In the five aggregates, usually you'd consider rupa khanda in the five aggregates as being the more or less equivalent to the body. But that may be one explanation of it, is that it's the, because the, dependent on the body, we actually have our sight, yeah? So we can actually see things. So maybe the objects of the senses might be the derived form. That would be one explanation. I think that's included in the Abhidhamma explanation. Not sure of the details of the Abhidhamma explanation there. But it does give a nice little hint a bit later on in the sutra as well. But we'll see from the sutra itself that the rupa is broader than just the body. Okay, so Patavi Dhatu, Apo Dhatu, Tejo Dhatu, Vayo Dhatu. Okay? Patavi, the earth. Apo, water. Tejo, fire. And Vayo, air. So last week we had some fun trying to guess which English words are related to these particular words. So I'd like to, anyone got any guesses? Which English words are related to these Pali words for the for five khandhas?
Four elements.
Oh, sorry, four elements, yeah. Meanwhile, I'm just going to cheat by asking Google.
The closest I can get, dhatu, it could be dirt, but it's not
at
the other end.
Dirt? Yeah. Dhatu. Any other? Any of the other words? Earth? Fire?
Vapor for air.
Vapor from air?
Well, sort of. VA.
Yeah, could be.
And tepo could be temperature. But
which one? Tejo? Temperate?
Temperatures.
Yeah. Actually, this is a bit of a trick question because I don't know any of these ones. But that... But I did find a book, which I can't find at the moment, but I did find a book that actually gives you the whole, it's like a whole book on the English and the relationship between the English and the Sanskrit roots. It discusses all of the roots. But anyway, okay, so I'm not aware of any English roots, but there may be some. So this is very important, this little group of four elements, okay? Now, of course, when we look at the four elements, we ask, what are they in modern terms? We'll see a bit more about how they're meant, but just to obviously, they're meant in a more kind of abstract sense than just, you know, earth. So the Patavi isn't just kind of dirt, right? And same with all the other ones. They're not just the basic physical thing that it's talking about, so in a sense it's abstracted. But it does correlate very well to the whole system of the states of matter in chemistry. So of course you have the basic states of matter, solid, liquid and gas. Patavi being solid, apo being liquid and vayo being gas, and tejo being what changes one into the other. Okay, so if you have ice you melt it with tejo dhatu and then you turn it into gas with tejo dhatu. So it actually works quite well in terms, if you understand, in terms of the states of matter in modern chemistry. Okay, but remember also that these things are, the emphasis on these things is always the inner perception of them, okay? So they're physical properties as perceived by the mind and not necessarily the same as the physical properties as experimented on by a chemist in the laboratory. And also remember that they're all gods.
In other mythic things.
Mm. So the Buddha's giving a kind of quite a rational explanation. They're just physical things, and it's explaining that way. But the normal way of seeing them is that, they're, of course, they're gods, because this is what gives you life. Yeah, Patavi is what gives you the gift of the earth. Okay, so the Patavi is worshipped as a deva, as a deity, because she's the one who actually gives the grain which you live on. And if the grain isn't fertilized with the water, then this also is, you die. So Apo is worshipped as a god. And so on. So all of these are actually deities, both in Indic and most other old ancient religions in one way or another, either directly or indirectly in terms of deities who represent or embody these kinds of properties. So the Buddha here is giving, or Sariputta is giving, a very naturalistic explanation of these things. So what is the... So always remember, that's in a sense, that's where he's coming from. So in a sense, you might think, well, it's obvious, and he's just talking about what the physical dirt is and stuff like that. But that's the point, is that that's what he's talking about. He's not talking about it in terms of any metaphysical speculations. He's just saying, well, this is the stuff here, and this is what you can observe. Yeah, you can observe that this is how it is. Okay, so what is the... And now going in further, earth element. What is the earth element? And then divides it into two. Patavi dhatu siya adhatika siya bahira. Bahira. So the internal and the external earth element. Okay?
Is this where Bhikkhupadi has note on this?
Okay, what's the internal earth element? Whatever is internal, pertaining to oneself, pachatang. Okay? Pachatang is like about oneself. Kakalang. Kakalang. So you can know what kakalang means by the sound of it, don't you? Kakalang means rough. Karigatang means what's gone into curry. Okay? So this means, you know, cumin and coriander and dried chili and stuff like that. Okay, so the element is solid. Okay, so whatever is solid, whatever is kakala, karigatang, is solidified. Upadinnang. Now, this is an interesting word, upadinnang. This is a past participle of the word upadana. Okay, so upadana means grasping, that goes in the grasping aggregates. And this is the upadinna, is what is grasped. Okay, and
clinging and grasping. In my book, it says clinging every time,
mm-hmm.
and you say grasping.
Mm.
But they do have a different meaning.
They do. What's the difference?
Well, clinging is hanging on, and grasping is grabbing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so clinging specifically means refusing to let go of something, yeah? Whereas that's not what upadana means in the Pali.
Well, we both have the Majjhima, and why are they so different?
That's because I make it up as I go along.
Ah.
So this is why I disagree with the translation of upadana as clinging. Because upadana is that the basic function, independent origination, is it's what produces a new life. It's not holding on to this life. It's going out and grabbing a new life. Yeah. So it's an active force which goes out and grasps stuff. It's not the refusal to let go of them. There's other words in Pali which you'd use to for that, like refusing to let go of something, which you'd say is clinging. Yeah? So this is what has been grasped. In other words, it's what's been taken up in this life. Okay. It's what's been taken up, i.e. our body. So the internal element is upadinna, is taken up and it's grasped. And this is a category again which became a standard category in the Abhidhamma as the upadinna rupa. Effectively it means something like organic matter, okay, or matter which is pertaining to the body, okay, as opposed to inorganic matter or you know, stuff out there.
Can I just go back to what you're saying to Eva? Clinging is also a refusal to it's that you can't let go.
Right.
So what's the difference?
That's what clinging is. Yeah, clinging is.
Is that too, that you aren't that because you're not letting go?
No, grasping is grabbing something. You grasp it. I mean, grasping could be also refusing to let go of something, but it doesn't specifically mean that.
Okay.
You know, whereas clinging means no, I'm not gonna let go. Yeah.
Grasping is the first movement to hold on and maintain.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
You mean that clinging is more strong, stronger?
Yeah, perhaps stronger, but the main difference is that clinging, grasping wants to get something new. Clinging that wants doesn't want to give up what it's already got.
You mean you grasp, maybe sometimes it will let go, but clinging will hold on.
Clinging, we don't want to let go of what we've already got. Yeah? Yeah, so, but both of them are true. We do both of those things, yeah? But the word upadana doesn't mean specifically refusing to let go of what we got. It means, now I'm going to finish this life, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get another one. Yeah? I'm going to grasp another one. Okay, moving right along. Upadinnang. So again, another important technical term for Buddhist philosophy. So it's good to know these things because you'll encounter these. Because they become used as technical words, they become divorced from their basic meaning and takes on a very specialized meaning, which doesn't really make sense in the context. Okay, and so then if you look at it, you think, what does that mean? What does that mean? Yeah. So for example, I think Venerable Nyanamoli in the Visuddhimagga, I think, translates it as clung to, if I'm not wrong. And so you read that and you think, clung to, you know, this is physical form that is clung to, and non-clung to physical form, what does that mean, right? So you don't know what it means, but actually this is what it means. It means taken up in rebirth at the start of a life, so, i.e. organic matter, okay? So this is so you can try to make sense of these things. Sayatidang, okay? So whatever internally is hard and stuff. Kesa, loma, naka, danta, tacho, mangsang, naharu, arti, arti, minjang, wakang, hadayang, yakanang, kilomakang, piyakang, paphasang, antang, anta, gunang, udaryang, karisang. Okay. Who knows what these are?
The 32 body parts.
32?
Well,
32
of the breath.
Okay. What's this one?
And womb is the outside.
Sorry? Head. Loma. So when it says your hair is standing up on end in Pali, it says your loma is standing up on end. Naka. Naka.
Nails. Teeth
and skin. Danta. Does that have any relation to English?
Dental.
Ah, very good. Tacho.
Skin.
Related to anything in English?
Tactile.
Yeah? Touching. Mangsang.
Flesh and sinews.
Api.
Bones.
Bones. Api minjang. Wakang.
Kidneys.
Wakang the kidneys?
Should be kidneys next after
bone marrow. Bone marrow. Wakang. Kidneys. Hadayang.
Heart.
Again, related to English. Heart. Had. Yeah.
Well. Liver.
Yakanang. It's because it's yucky. The liver is yucky, so that's why they call it yakanang.
Very clever.
Spoke to one last week.
Kilomakang. Kilomakang.
Spleen.
Diaphragm.
Diaphragm should be in the middle between spleen and lungs.
Piyakang. Spleen. Papasang. Papasa. Papasa. It's the lungs, yeah? Intestines. Antang. Antagunang. Udaryang.
Contents of the stomach.
Karisang.
Contents of the bowel.
What's the contents of the bowel?
Excrement.
Excrement, thank you, yeah. In Thai they say ahan, ahan, my ahan, ga, old, new food and old food. Okay, so this is solid, right.
Where's brain? What's the word for brain?
Included in the 31 parts.
Yeah, they don't have. Sometimes it's included, considered as being a variety of bone marrow.
Which is silly, isn't it, really? Even if it's in the sutta.
It's not in the sutta.
Or, but it's not supposed to be a comprehensive list because it says, Yava pananyampi genchi ajatang pachatang kakalang karihadang upadinang, or whatever. That's similar, okay? So this is a list which is usually understood as being taken from a standard medical list of parts of the body, okay? So it's supposed to be like a generally accepted list of what the different bits of the body are, and it's not meant to be comprehensive. And this yangwa pananyampi, this is also another phrase which is yeva pananya, where yeva pananya is a very common phrase used in the Abhidhamma, and it means or whatever else, okay? So you have this thing in the Abhidhamma, just as this list, the canonical Abhidhamma, it lists all the different Dhammas, and then it says, or whatever else. Okay, so it's not trying to be comprehensive, it's not trying to list everything there is. It's saying, well, these are the important examples, or whatever else that's similar. And then in the the commentaries in the Visuddhimagga and the Atthasalani, and then it takes up the Yevapananya and lists what all of the things in the Yevapananya are. So it does try to be comprehensive. Okay, so it tries to actually list every individual thing.
What do eyes come under? Membrane?
I don't think they really fit in there.
I've never seen eyes in any of these lists.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, it's not really meant to be comprehensive. So, whatever is internal. Oh, did we go to the internal? Ajatang? This is the Ajatang, right? Right. Now, whatever is the internal earth element and the external earth element, then this is regarded as just the earth element, okay? So, he hasn't actually defined what the external earth element is. Anyway, you look at all of it as being not me, not myself, and so on, in accordance with the, again here, Sariputta quoting from the Anattalakkhana Sutta, and the basic reflection on the not-self there. So when you're looking at it in that way, patividhatu ya nibindati, patividhatu ya chittang virajeti, so the mind, one has nibida for the earth element, and the mind has dispassion, virajeti, for the earth element. Now, it starts to tell the story of the end of the world. There comes a time, hoti ko avuso samayo. Okay, so this is the phrase, hoti ko so samayo, hoti ko pana samayo, is a phrase that means there comes a time when, it's an idiom in Pali. Yang bahira apodhatu pakupati. So remember, he hasn't really defined what the external earth element is. But now he's talking about it being pakupati, is being disturbed or upset. Antarihita tasming samaye bahira parividhatu hoti. And then the external earth element vanishes. Antarihita.
Why is he talking about the water element?
I'll come on to that in a minute. We'll read through it and then we'll come back to that. Tasahi nama avuso bahiraya parividhatu ya. Okay, so then even this external earth element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body? Kimpani masa matta takasa kayasa, what of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while?
You take it up by craving.
Which is... which is grasped by craving, yeah? Upadhanha, there's an extra A in there. So again,
grasped by craving, that's pretty enormous, isn't it?
At the end of the paragraph 7. It lasts but a while. So here, upadina, again the body, upadina. Okay, so there can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. Okay, ahantiva, I, mamantiva, mine, asmitiva, I am. There's none of that. Atakvasa no cheve tahoti. There's none of that. That's just a footnote in the thing. I tried to get rid of them all, but I missed out a few.
What is Taz mean again?
In that. Where's Tasming here?
Tasming, second line, second word.
Tasming samaye. So in that, or here it is at that time. Tasming samaye.
It's in the things we chant, when we used to chant. Nibindati and Tasming.
Alright. Okay, so to come back to Max's question, why when the external water element is disturbed, does the earth element disappear? Sorry? Yeah, that's got all the good stuff on it. Why?
It's like when you're dying, at a particular stage where you're swept away as though by a great river, and a certain colour arises. I can't remember. Magic.
What's the question again?
Why does it say when is the water element disappears?
Yeah.
So it's disturbed, and then the earth element disappears.
It would occur in that order. If you should think supernova-wise, the water will evaporate first, and then the harder things, which are compact,
uh-huh.
durable, will then disappear after that.
Uh-huh.
That's why the Buddha says the great oceans dry up first, go down to 1 foot.
Or if the great oceans rise by 25 meters, then the earth element also disappears. Yeah.
No, it'll still be there. It's just not seeable, not viewable.
You think that's hardly even worth mentioning as far as disasters go? It's nothing.
You'll get supernova.
Supernova is the only one worth worrying about.
Yeah, change of the Kalpa.
That sounds good.
So in Indic cosmology, the earth is resting on water. So the earth floats on water. So when the water element is disturbed, then the earth is also disturbed.
React.
So the basic idea is that the different elements are interdependent, which of course is, even though we don't see the earth in the same way as that, but the idea that they're interdependent is still very much with us. And this is what we're seeing with the global warming, is that when the change in the fire element, then all the other elements are disturbed as well. Now, I just give from Venerable Anālaya here, both versions apply the same treatment and reflections to the other three elements. While the Hayatipadokuma Sutra and its Chinese parallel proceed in a fairly similar manner when describing the internal manifestations of each element, they differ in regard to the external counterparts, which is what we're dealing with here. The Pali version first mentions that the water element on being disturbed destroys the earth element. Next, the Mahahatipadokuma Sutta has again the water element being disturbed, resulting in the destruction of villages and whole countries caused by floods, followed by the water of the great ocean drying up in stages until none is left. The Pali account continues by describing the fire element and the air element being disturbed, in each case causing destruction followed by the same element disappearing. In considering the Pali presentation, it should be noted that the disturbance of the water element occurs twice, while the disturbance of the earth element does not occur at all. Just sort of reading here, there is one addition from a Burmese version which does have the Patavi Dhatu being disturbed, but that is not supported by the commentary, so it's likely to be a later change. So sorry, just to come back to that. The treatment of the earth element is moreover rather brief and differs from the way how the other elements are treated, where in each case the Pali version offers a detailed description of the destruction caused followed by describing the disappearance of the respective element. The Chinese version proceeds in a more uniform manner, attributing the destruction of each element to another element. It agrees with the Pali on the element earth being destroyed by the water element, but then continues with the water element drying up due to fire calamity, fire coming to an end when reaching water and running out of fuel, and strong wind as a manifestation of the air element coming to an end when reaching the mountains, which represent the earth element. So the detailed descriptions of these things is quite different in the different suttas. The Chinese version's attribution of the destruction of the water element to the impact caused by the fire element can claim for support a discourse from the Anguttara Nikaya together with its parallels in the Madhyama Agama and the Ekottara Agama, which describe the gradual drying up of the great ocean in similar terms as the Mahahatipadokuma Sutta. According to these discourses, the cause for such a drying up of the ocean is the arising of several suns. So here's Venerable Jaga's supernova, an event which would evidently have to be reckoned as a manifestation of the fire element. One would imagine so, yes. According to another discourse from the Anguttara Nikaya, even a drought would have to be attributed to a disturbance of the fire air element and not to a disturbance of the water element. This discourse describes altogether five causes for drought, three being interference of the asuras, one being the indolence of the devas responsible for rain and evil conduct among humans, while the other two are when the element of fire or the element of air in the sky are disturbed, dispersing the clouds and thereby preventing rain. So notice what I said before about these things being regarded as deities and devas and so on. So these kinds of more animistic beliefs are still found in various places in the suttas, but they don't seem to be fairly tangential, and when we come to the major doctrinal discussions, they're not really found. They're more just in the kind of illustrative and narrative elements.
Just by the way, our sun is unlikely to supernova. It's too small.
Too small, yeah. Too boring.
Yeah. So it will become. It will just grow and grow and grow and will
red dwarf.
Giant.
Red giant. Yeah. So that would. So to describe it as being looking like several suns in the sky is probably not such a bad description.
Maybe the Earth will even be swallowed, or inner planets will be swallowed.
Yeah. So there's some doubt about the exact descriptions of the external Earth elements here. Possibly they were a result, the exact descriptions were a result of the later developments in the tradition.
Is the only element based on this center?
Some of it is, yeah. Some of it's related to it, yeah.
And they took this up and started thinking away.
It could be, yeah. I mean, that's what I found out in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta is that it seems that there's like the Abhidhamma took the Satipatthana Sutta and then made that into their bit on Satipatthana, but then elaborated it, but then that got fed back again into the suttas. Okay, so it wasn't just a one-way process, but it also fed back from the Abhidhamma into the suttas. Well, they added elaborations on the explanations in the Abhidhamma.
Into
the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, yeah. So it sort of goes up and then comes down again. Yeah? And so a similar thing may have happened here. I haven't investigated this one in detail, but a similar thing could have happened where, the whole thing was subject to later elaboration. And just in working out some of the details, but the basic framework, again, is always very similar in the Pali and Chinese, but just some of the details. Okay. Right. Now, then some others might abuse that bhikkhu, revile him and attack him, and hassle him. And then he understands, now, there has arisen for me this painful feeling, which is arisen, jha, okay, arisen, by contact through the ear. Okay, so jha, being a suffix based on jati, of course, born, so ear contact born, dukkha vedana. Okay, sacho paticca, that is conditioned, paticca, no apaticca, not apaticca, not conditioned, right? Paticca is the literal analysis of paticca is it's from the root I, to go. Okay, and it's a gerundive form, so it's a gerund form, and so it's not have and then falling back on the pati here means to go back to, so it's going but going back to, yeah, so it's like leaning back against. Okay, so not having leaned back against. It's a literal understanding of what paticca means.
What did you translate it as?
It's conditioned. Not leaning back against.
Okay, what sort of a painful feeling are we talking about in the ear?
In the ear? Oh, well, when you get upset, somebody abuses you.
Well, that's not where you get a painful feeling. Not in your ear. If somebody abuses you.
Does it say that the feeling's in the ear?
That you might get hurt in your gut, but not in your ear.
But does it say that it's hurt in your ear?
Well, it says here, this painful feeling born of ear contact.
Right. So I was born in Subiaco Hospital, right? Now, does that mean I'm in Subiaco Hospital?
Okay.
So it isn't. That's another. It is an interesting point. Is it the actual ear consciousness which is painful, or not?
Well, it is if there's a loud bring noise or something.
Right. Yeah.
There's two sorts.
Or you have to listen to like loud rock and roll too much or something like that. Some people think it's painful, but here, yeah, it's the effect of it. Yeah, the emotional impact of it.
What would it be, sankhara?
What?
What the emotional effect?
It's sanya, whatever you want to call it, yeah.
Not vedana.
It's just dukkha vedana.
Yeah, the emotion of being upset would be a sanya or sankara or something, and then it's associated with the dukkha vedana. What is it dependent on? It's dependent on contact. That contact is impermanent. He sees that feeling is also impermanent. The perception is impermanent. Sankharas are impermanent. Consciousness is impermanent. Tasa dhata ramana meva titang bakhandati pasidati santittati adhimuchati. So, dependent on just that element, okay, as a support, supported by aramana, okay, with that element as aramana, the mind leaps forward, becomes confident, steadied, and decisive, okay. Now, in the Chinese, has a slight variation on that particular phrase, and it says, Chinese has becomes quiet and one-pointed. And so possibly this, certainly this word here, santittati, is very often used in context of samadhi. It seems that some of the reflections on not self and things like that are found more commonly in the Pali version than they are in the Chinese version. So it seems perhaps that the Pali's been edited with more of an eye to the vipassana aspects of this, and the samatha aspects of it are more emphasized in the Chinese. This again was something that I suspected in when I was doing the research for History of Mindfulness, that the Chinese preserves slightly more of an emphasis on the samatha practices in some suttas as opposed to the Pali, but just a very, very slight, and it's quite it's just a speculation, really. It's not really anything firm enough to go on, but certainly in some places it does. Whether that's a general truth or not is not really certain. This is Sarvastivada. Yeah, the Chinese Sarvastivada. All right.
Decisive and decision.
Yeah.
That's just grammatical.
So, then, monks, those other people do things which are unwished for, undelightful, unpleasant, okay, and they attack you with fists, pani, fists, clods, leddu, we've seen that before, the clods of dirt, danda, we know well what a danda is, satta, swords, okay. So he understands this. This body is of such a nature that fists, clods, sticks, and knives assail it. Okay, tatha bhuto. It's thus come to be. Okay, thus come to be is this body. Yatha bhutang, in such a way. Okay, yatha bhutang means a body constituted in such a way. It's come to be in such a way. This body that. So that all these things attack it. Yeah. So this is how you reflect.
Isn't this the thing they translate? They like to translate as see things as they really are, isn't it?
Not quite. No. Yatha bhuta. Would they translate as they really are? Yeah.
It means
that as it's come to be. Yeah. As it's come to be. It's been produced in such a way. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, so what it means is we've been born with this kind of body. You know, we've just been born with this kind of body where this kind of stuff happens, you know. Rutang ko panetang bhagavata kakatupama vade. This has been said by the Blessed One in the Kakatupama discourse, okay? So here, quoting, of course, the sutta we did a few weeks ago. Even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Okay?
What's the saw again?
The kakacha. Kakacha. Alright? Okay, so then he's going to really try, going to put forth effort. Ah, radhang, rouse up, will be my energy. Okay, my virya, my virileness. Okay, my virileness will be roused up. Okay, that's what it says. Sounds like me. I suddenly know. And mindfulness is established at pamutta. There's not only a samutta.
Tireless energy, it says here.
Yeah. I like my version better. And then pasadho kayo asaradho, body is tranquil and undisturbed. Samahitang chittang ekagang, the mind is one-pointed. Now notice again, I mentioned last week about how these use of synonyms in these things. Okay, so here aradha, virya, and asalina, these are all synonyms, three synonyms used in the same word, just basically all to mean energy. Patita, sati, and asamutha, that's not what pamutta is wrong. These again are all synonyms, mindfulness, established mindfulness, unconfused, okay? Pasadho, kayo, asaradho, body is tranquil and undisturbed, all synonyms. Samahi, chittang, the mind is concentrated and one-pointed. These again are all synonyms, okay? And so these words commonly used together in a sense of emphasis. And also it's partly emphasis and the rhetorical nature of it, but also it's a kind of data preservation device, because you can lose half the sentence and it still means the same thing, okay?
Lose half the sentence.
Yeah.
And still mean the same.
Yeah.
If you do samahitang out, then it will say
chittang ekagang. Yeah. It still mean the same thing. And even if you took chitta out and you just said ekagang, it would still mean one pointed.
Okay. Is that unremitting mindfulness?
Unmuddled, they change that.
Unremitting could be, yeah. Unconfused. So related to the root to be confused, moha, right? Just reflect on one's own experience. It's a normal state of being. Okay? So, kamang dani. So here it has kamang dani, kamang. And this is used, this is the word karma, normally meaning, of course, sensual desires, sensual pleasures. But here it's used, when it's used often in an idiom at the beginning of the sentence, kamang, it means willingly. Kamang dani, now. So willingly, now, let this body be attacked with all of these things, okay? Because by doing this, I am practicing the Buddha's teachings. Okay? So it's like bring it on. That's what it means. It means bring it on, man. When that bhikkhu thus recollects the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, equanimity, which is supported by the wholesome, is not established or set up, not firm in him. So because of that, he becomes, has a sense of sangvega, he is moved. Literally is moved. Vega is to move. Okay? Sangvega. He is emoted. Right? As an emotion. Yeah? He is moved. He is roused up. He is stirred. Okay? And translated as a sense of urgency here. Okay? So sangvijati. He has a sense of urgency. So sangvega is what happens when you see some kind of incidents of psychic power, someone flies up into the air and bursts into a ball of flame or something like that, and then they're all sangvega, and their hairs stand up on the back of their neck and these kinds of things. So this is what sangvega is like. Oh my God. Awe. A sense of awe. Yeah? Okay. So then he considers, it is no gain for me. Vata. Vata has a sense of, alas. Oh. Oh, it's very bad for me. When recollecting the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, then the equanimity dependent on what is wholesome is not established. So Eva, what's this equanimity based on what's wholesome?
Upekha.
What does it mean?
Indifference supported by the wholesome. That doesn't sound right.
It means that when good things happen, you don't get overexcited by them, and when bad things happen, you don't get too disappointed and upset by them.
How do you not?
The sutta is giving you the method, okay? Right. Now, just as when a daughter-in-law, Sunisa, sees her father-in-law, Sasurang, Niswa.
That's significant. I wondered that when I read that.
Yeah. I think the idea is always, it's like a simile. Buddha uses it as a simile. He says for the monks, he said just like when a daughter-in-law, because the women would go to have, when they were married, they would go and live in the husband's family. And so he says like for the monks, you know, when there's a new bride and she comes into the house, and when she first arrives and she's very eager to please, yeah, and she's just come into a new household, so she really wants to be nice and to do all the right things and to try to please everybody and be very respectful and everything. And then later on, she gets really complacent and lazy and starts to get arrogant and bosses people around and tells them what to do and stuff like that. Yeah. So he says, monks, don't you be like this. Yeah. You should be like a sunisa, like a new bride who's newly arrived in the house.
But why did he choose father-in-law? Why not say brother-in-law or mother-in-law?
Because I guess the father-in-law is the authority figure in that context.
That makes sense.
So she's trying to please him. Yeah? In the household. So this is another example, Samvega. So then gains enthusiasm and rouses himself up and then manages to establish the pekha kusala nisita, and then they are Atamanohoti, they are pleased with themselves. And to this extent, much has been done by that bhikkhu. Okay? So this is quite a nice thing. I always quite like this to say, well, it's, you know, it's not necessarily gained any huge attainments or anything like that, but he's got some degree of reflection and control over his mind, and so that's much has been done. It's a good thing.
That's funny, bhikkhu's translation, equanimity supported by the wholesome becoming established. You say about the wholesome, is that right?
No, supported by the wholesome, yeah. Kusala nisita. Yeah. Okay, so now what, friends, is the water element? The water element may be either internal or external. What's the internal water element? Whether internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, and clung to. Okay, so water, apo, watery, apo gatang. Okay? So here the suffix gatang, translated as watery, okay? It literally means gone to, okay? So it means something like come to the state of being water, something like that. And clung to, upadina. Seyatinang. Bile. Pitang. Phlegm. Semhang. Pumbo. Pass. Lohitang. Sedo. Medo. Medo? Fat. So, medo is fat, and you can remember medo because it's like meta.
Or meadow lee.
Meadow lee, yeah.
That's very cool.
That's very good, yeah.
Yeah. Well, last.
You've got to be congratulated.
Yeah, you should be congratulated for that, yeah. And, Netta. Okay. So in the commentarial explanation it says it makes you fat, that's why it's metta, okay? Because like metta and metta are the same.
Like the laughing Buddha.
Like the laughing Buddha.
Like metta and fatta.
Sorry?
Like metta and fatta.
Metta and fatta.
Metta and metta.
Oh, metta.
And so so of course you have metteya, which we translate as Maitreya, meaning the one who has metta, okay? But actually in the suttas the metteya is only used in one sense, and it doesn't mean one who has metta, it means the filial piety to one's mother. This is what metteya means. You have metteya petteya, It means the duties and respect which are deserving to one's mother and father. Okay, so perhaps that's the original meaning of what metta is. But then metta, of course, the mother, when she gets pregnant, of course, is metta, and she's fat. And so this is the metta. And so when Maitreya went to China, then he got very fat. Yeah, and so this is why they have the fat Buddha, is Maitreya. Because he's fat, like a pregnant woman. He's always got babies crawling all over him.
Reaching a big
sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah. No, it's true.
What about metta being related to mitta?
And mitta, yeah. And so metta is mitta. And so this is why Maitreya is also related to Mithras. Mitra is the ancient Vedic god. His Persian incarnation was called Mithras. And you have Mithras Invictus in Latin, is the invincible Mithra. And in Pali you have the Ajita Maitreya, the invincible Maitreya. And that was they were worshipped in the Central Asian region. Something like that.
So the word matron as well, I imagine.
Probably, yeah. Mother, maternal. And of course, mateship. Right. So I bet when all Australian guys are saying mate, they've got no idea how ancient the roots that they're talking about. They go right back thousands of years. Okay. Meda, asu. Is tears. Vasa. Grease, kelo, spit, singhanika, snot, lassika.
And what's kelo? Because it's in one book and not the other book, and I can't figure out what it means.
Spit.
What is it?
Spit. So, okay. Lassika is the oil of synovial fluid is the actual proper name for it. Muttang urine. Yangwa pananyampi kinchi ajatang pachatang apo apagatang. So whatever other kind of watery stuff is inside the body is part of the water element, internal water element. Now, and the internal water element and external water element are just considered water elements. So see how it's moving in its synthesis, okay? So it's taking these two things which you can see as separate, and it's pointing out there's a common quality to them, which is the fact that they're watery, yeah? So it's a synthetic method. It's moving from the separative thing to and they're both not me and not mine. So normally, of course, we consider the internal water element to be myself and external water element to be not myself. And so we make that distinction, but here it's saying, well, actually, there's no difference. It's just water element. So you look at them both in the same way. Okay. Now, there comes a time when the external water element is disturbed, then it carries away vahati, villages and towns and cities and countries and janapadampi, and whole countries and whole nations, regions are carried away. And so this is what we're facing at the moment. Yeah? There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean sink down 100 leagues, 200 leagues. So the league, of course, is the yojana, related to the word yoga, to yoke, and it originally was the distance that you could drive a team of horses before having to change them over. And there's various estimates of what a yojana is. I think it's usually about 12 k's or something for a yojana. Any idea?
Well, this is straight down.
Yeah.
3 is 46.
Mm. Yeah, something like that. Maybe 12 k's or 14 k's, something like that. They work out how big a yojana is. There's various measurements in the ancient texts, like in the Artha Shastra and things, and also they have ancient measurements, so it'll say in the books it was so far from Savatthi to Kosambi, and so now we can dig them up from Savatthi to Kosambi and we can work out exactly how far it actually is. So you work out how big a yojana is. So the water goes down and the water in the great ocean stands only 7 palms deep, 6 fathoms deep, two palms deep, only a palm deep, then seven, of course, being a palm tree rather than a palm tree, not a hand palm, and it's 6 fathoms deep and so on, is the Satapurisa, is a fathom, half a fathom deep, only waist deep, only knee deep, and only ankle deep. Okay, so there comes a time when the waters in the great ocean are not enough to wet even the joint of a finger. Okay, anguli pabate mana matampi. Okay, so if when even this external water element, as great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. Okay. Right. And again, then he reflects in the same way as previously, and much has been done by that bhikkhu. So notice how when he does that reflection, you know, he's saying that this experience includes the feeling and the perception and so on. So there's this kind of integration of all the 5 khandhas. It's not like when he's looking at the 5th khandha, the material form, it's not like something separate from all the other khandhas. It's all intermingled. Yeah. So you're using the physical form as your way in. That's your portal. So this is your basis for your reflection. But the others are all involved in that. Yeah. So you see how they are linked up with that. There's no kind of separation of the khandhas.
What are you thinking of when you say that?
The reflection that is abbreviated there. I meant to mention that earlier when we talked about it, when it talks about this painful feeling born of ear contact, and then that contact is impermanent, feelings permanent, impermanent, and all that stuff. Yeah, and it's putting those things together. Okay, tejo dhatu. Okay, so what is the internal earth element? Yena cha santapati, whatever one is heated, one has the tapas. Yena cha jariyati, so jariyati is whatever one becomes geriatric about. Okay, so here to age, jariyati is being the verb form of jara, to age, and so it's generally understood that the heat element is the element of aging. Which of course is something that you can see if you hang out in somewhere like Byron Bay or something like that, and you see all the old surfers who've been lying around in the sun for so many years, and they get aged very quickly by the sun. Yena cha paridaihati, okay, whatever is consumed, okay, paridaihati. And whatever is eaten, drunk, chewed, and savored is rightly digested. Parinamang gachati is the idiom to digest. And so again, the digestive system is said to be dependent on the fire element. So you're thought to digest things in the same way that a fire digests. You put all things in a fire and it digests it. So the same way your stomach digests things according to the fire element. Okay. Now, when the external fire element is disturbed, it burns up villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. It goes out due to lack of fuel only when it comes to a green grass, or to a road, or a rock, or to water, or to a fair open space. Okay, so this being a good reflection for Australian forest monastics, and especially as we're coming into the hot season. Then there comes a time when they seek to make a fire even with a cock's feather or a hide paring, when even this external fire element, as great as it seems to be, is impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and craving. What of this body which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? So, you know, in these examples, it's giving like a twofold thing, that the fire element becomes out of balance either way. Either it just becomes excessive and just goes over the top and burns everything, or else it just doesn't have anything to burn anymore and completely disappears. In either way, it just doesn't work. The world doesn't work. It goes out. So our lives are dependent on this. It's a little bit like what they call the Goldilocks problem in physics.
What's that?
You heard of that? No. Never heard of Goldilocks?
Porridge.
And what about Goldilocks' porridge?
Yes.
What about
it? Not too cold.
It's just right.
Yeah? So there's something about the universe which is just right.
And it also disappears?
No, to be human.
The anthropic.
The anthropic principle, exactly, yeah. Sometimes known as the Goldilocks problem. So this is one of the things which the modern theoretical physicists sort of wrestle with, is why if you tweaked the speed of light by a little bit, or if you tweaked any of the other physical constraints of the universe, then the universe wouldn't happen. The stars wouldn't form, everything would be black holes, or nothing would happen, or whatever, and we wouldn't be here. But why is everything just right? Of course, the intelligent design school has no problem in explaining that.
Is that effect upon tsunamis?
This was interesting because it's conditional. I mean, that's really what the whole sutta is about. Everything is conditioned. It's not like this. It's all changing all the time.
Uh-huh.
So there's no place, I mean, unless it's very, very temporary, that you could say it's just right.
It's just right in the sense that we can, at least we can be here. So they're not trying to pretend that it's a perfect world, but that at least, you know, there's a very narrow range where, you know, as we're seeing, like, even if the temperature increases by 3 degrees, the average temperature, then life is going to become pretty dicey. If it was by 10 degrees, then you probably wouldn't have a hope. Yeah. So there's a very, very narrow range. So why is everything in that narrow range? So you can understand some things. Yeah, you can understand, okay, you get a lucky strike with some bits, but why is everything in the universe seemingly arranged so that we can be here and not that we cannot be here?
Well, it's not arranged.
I don't know, it's a question.
Yeah, because it's like that. This because of that. Yeah.
Just how it is, and there's no deeper explanation than that. Just chance.
No, it's the conditions coming together, right?
Yeah, but it's just the right condition.
Right, exactly. But it won't be.
But if there weren't, then it wouldn't.
If there weren't, then it wouldn't.
Then the human beings would perhaps look different or something.
If it wasn't like that, nobody could ask the questions.
Nobody would be there to ask the questions, yeah. If it wasn't right, then nobody could wonder why it's right or wrong. there'd be no one to worry about it. Yeah, in that case, maybe that's just a point of view. Maybe it's actually wrong, and because if it had been done properly, then we wouldn't be bothering with this kind of silly question. Yeah.
Doesn't modern physics say that you need an observer for reality to be there?
That's some interpretations of quantum theory. Yeah.
How could there be a universe without an observer?
How could there be a universe without an observer? Well, if you follow that kind of interpretation of quantum cosmology, quantum gravity, then it can't. So the universe only can exist when consciousness exists.
So people who believe in the God theory would love that perspective.
You know, well, if
moving on.
Well, according to some interpretations of quantum theory, then the universe can't come into existence unless there's an observer. So especially quantum gravity theory. So according to these theories, the Big Bang is a quantum singularity. So it needs an observer to actually watch it, in some sense. And so then raises the kind of interesting question about who might possibly be the observer. I think it's like in the restaurant at the end of the universe. It's actually like McDonald's or something like that. They've got a big kind of screen and everyone's sitting around there watching it all happen.
In the suttas, does it not say all beings are ejected from hell towards the end of the kalpa? So they would become, and they become devas, and they become the observers perhaps of the new Big Bang.
Yeah.
Streaming radiance.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was the theory I developed in my essay on beginnings.
Those from the hell realms or the deva realms? The deva realms are dependent on Earth, right?
Yeah, in the higher deva realms, from the Abhasara on, according to that says. But Yeah, so it is an interesting philosophical question, but I think it's anyway, just so you know, this is a major topic of controversy among physicists about the anthropic principle. Some of them think it's a non-problem. Others use it to draw quite significant conclusions from.
Bante, just to come back to the thing in hand here, it doesn't mention that you need fire for decomposition. Do you need fire for decomposition?
For decomposition, I think that would be kind of implied in the paridaihati.
In the when Buddha speaks about the digestion and, you know, the living and digestion and decomposition.
I think paridaihati translates as confused. Sorry, consumed. Confused, consumed. So that maybe mean decomposition?
I just need to know because in my corpse meditation I use heat.
Uh-huh. That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, you're fine. Yeah, that's no problem.
Because in ice, things don't decompose.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so we burnt up all the villages and towns and so on. So
the samana with the single fork.
Yeah. Well, it's better than a nuclear weapon. Okay. Gatama Jabasu Vayodhatu. Okay. What's the internal air element? What is internally is air and airy. Vayogatang. Okay. Seyatidang. Such as the upgoing winds. Wind, the udhang is the upgoing. Going, gama is the going. Udhang, winds going up. Adho gama vata. Winds going down. Any volunteers? Winds in the belly, okay? So this is what this winds in the belly. This is we heard about Eva's winds in the belly when she started taking lots of garlic, yeah, and it was awful.
I think we can move that away.
But it's true, isn't it? Yeah, and you get these kinds of things, and they grind around in your belly. Okay.
The Ayurvedic man said it was a good sign.
Yeah, winds in the bowels, and the winds that course through the limbs, angamanga nusarino. One of the things about the air element is always supposed to be the element of movement. Okay? So in this respect, it's quite different from Western physics. In Western physics, heat is the same as movement. Okay? So when you say you heat something up, effectively what you're saying is you're making the molecules move faster. Right? But here, in Indic way of thinking, the air element is the element of moving, because of course the air is always sort of moving around. It's not moving at the moment. Okay, it's not a very good illustration, but often it's moving around the place. And you say, like, as fast as the wind, yeah? So you move as fast as the wind. And so the air element is the one that sort of moves everything around. And so the those things which are actually moving the limbs. And of course, the in-breath and out-breath. Now, it depends. This one is one of the most interesting ones to interpret, but of course, in Indic thought, of course, you have the prana. So here has the, it's translated as vata, it's just the air. But the wind, again being a vayo being a deity, but the prana also is the breath. And various kinds of prana or breath are described in some detail in the Upanishads. Again, in a similar way to this, you have the upgoing breath and the downgoing breath and different kinds of breaths, and so on. And they're often interpreted by meditators, for example, by Ajahn Lee Dhammadharo, as being like the energies in the body. And so this is, you can actually kind of, when you experience in your meditation, you sit down, you experience the kind of the movement of energies in different parts of the body, then this is the movements of the air element. Okay? Like the chi, the breath element. Okay? Now then, the wind element comes and blows away all the towns and villages and everything like that. Okay? Tornadoes. This is when Dorothy finds out she's not in Kansas anymore. Okay. Then there comes a time when in the last month of the hot season. Gimhanang Patime Mase. Gimhana is the Gimha is the hot season? Summer? Patime is the last month. Masa is month. When they seek wind by means of a fan or a bellows, and even the strands of straw in the drip fringe of the thatch do not stir. Okay? That's a nice vivid, very, very vivid image. Paragraph 22. Yeah, so if you've lived in a grass-roofed dwelling, and you, over the end of the grass-roofed dwelling, the thatch comes down, and then just the ends of the grass hang down over the end, and they're kind of moving, even just a little bit of breeze.
What does Gimhanang
is the hot season, summer, but in the last month of the hot season. So this is what they call the tropo season in Darwin. Because it's become hot, and it's just been hot for as long as you can remember, and it's just hot every day and it's hot every night, and it's just this build up of this tension, yeah, and it just builds up, and the humidity, this incredible humidity in the air. So sometimes it's not raining, but the air squeezes out water. You can actually feel droplets of water being squeezed out because the humidity is so high, and it's just this impressive thing. So everyone goes mad.
Of course.
Yeah, and then the thunderclouds build up. And there's the lightning, and you see the lightning, and everyone's just kind of waiting for it to break, and then eventually it breaks. Yeah.
When you say the air squeezes out water, like on glass and on
objects? No, you can just feel it. You can feel it actually coming out of the sky. Yeah. You're just walking down the street, you can just feel like little droplets come out.
Right. Just because of the mist, the sort of the...
Humidity is so high, yeah.
An intense weather experience, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, they call it the tropo season. And they drink even more beer. That's the solution.
Dehydrating more.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so again, this is just repeating the passage. One is abused and reviled and reflects this is dependence. And then one sees that the contact, the feeling, the perception, sankharas, consciousness, are all dependent, all impermanent. And repeating the same passage we had earlier. So, that's all good. Then, much has been done by the bhikkhu and by the bhikkhuni at that time.
That's the first time today you remember.
I think missed a passage, number 26.
Number
26. So easy to...
Oh, I did. Yeah, you're right. Where am I? Oh, here I am. I'm fine, purely by mistake. Okay. Now, that's a very interesting one. Friends, just as when a space... So now we're on paragraph 26. Friends, just as when a space is enclosed by timber and creepers. Okay? Valincha paticha. Dianancha paticha. Very important, this one. Grass and clay. Matikancha paticha. Akaso pariwarito. Oh, pari. Pari is... all around. Varita is enclosed. Okay? Parivarito. Then it comes to be termed a house. Agaranteva sankhang gachati. So this is, it's like it's given, or gachati. Literally goes to the reckoning. So this is a thing that means it's generally recognized as being a house. Okay? Agaranteva. Evmeva kawavuso. When the space is enclosed by bones and sinews, flesh and skin, it comes to be termed just material form. Rupanteva. So here we talked about before, this is where rupa is used to mean its more narrow meaning of meaning the physical body. So the bigger body's note there.
Is this the same space that is in that interesting jhana?
Infinite space.
Is that the same space?
What kind of space is the space in jhana?
Well, I'm asking.
Well, what does it say?
The of space, the...
Of what kind of space?
Infinite space.
I'm asking.
Well, what does it say?
Boundless.
Boundless space, infinite space. Yeah?
Yeah.
And so what kind of space is this?
This is the same sort infinite. Of space, except it's
bounded. Ah. So then it's not the kind of same kind of space, is it?
Yes.
Right.
No, it must be. Is it the same space?
It's the same word, yeah. But if it's a bounded space, it's not the same as an infinite space.
Well,
Well, infinite space means it doesn't have a fence or anything.
Right, right. Or anything. Exactly.
A small dog.
So can we use this passage to say that space is conditioned?
Space is conditioned. Ah, okay, very good. So this is a controversy in the later Abhidhamma schools. How many unconditioned elements are there? So everyone agrees that Nibbana is unconditioned, right? But are there other things that are also unconditioned? Now, many schools, such as the Sarvastivadin, said that space is unconditioned.
And Ajahn Sumedho says space.
And Ajahn Sumedho, and incidentally, the Upanishads say that space is unconditioned.
When I feel space with metta, it's all space.
Mm-hmm.
Can we give her a bite?
Unconditioned.
You know, like you wrote a book about space.
Already?
There's a little book about space.
Who?
Ajahn Sumedho? Just full stop is unconditioned. It doesn't describe what kind of space.
I don't know how to
because,
say
because, you know, his sound of sound, well,
isn't space conditioned by the absence of matter?
Well, yeah, this is exactly what seems to be saying here, is that there's that the very fact that there are the things constructing it, we have a space inside a house, but the space inside a house is constructed by the fact that there are the four walls, yeah? And that's just what conditions it. So other things that may be unconditioned as well. Concepts are regarded as unconditioned in some schools. Yeah, including the Pali in certain sub-commentaries and so on.
If you look at the higher jhanas, everything previous to the last jhana is all, even the last jhana is still conditioned.
Mm.
So how can you say space is unconditioned?
Well, that's another one. Is Nirodha Samapatti, is that unconditioned? Some schools claim that the attainment of cessation is unconditioned as well.
But how conditioned leading up to that attainment?
Mm, that's true. But so does Nirvana.
But once you hit Nirvana, there's no going back to conditioned reality.
Mm.
The only difference between Nirodha Samapatti.
Mm. Go on.
Even if the boundless space has no boundaries, doesn't it have a center where the knower is, where the knowing happens?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's the condition for the space.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there is absolutely nothing, then...
Yeah.
But
there's still consciousness, which is why the place of infinite consciousness is next. But according to physics, then space is conditioned, isn't it? Because if before you have a Big Bang, there's no space. Space is all wrapped up in the Big Bang, yeah? And you can't sort of go outside here and measure space. It doesn't make sense.
Physics is more like you need several objects to define space.
To define space.
Mathematics. A point is enough. From that.
One point.
One point, and the things around. You don't need things actually. You just say, well. I define a unit, different directions, and then that's it.
So you put the same thing with this in terms of the house defines space, whether or not physics say the tip of a needle is the encapsulation of space before the Big Bang takes place.
Mm.
It's no different for the house.
Yep.
Space. The concept is the same.
Space expands when the things expand. If you build extensions on your house, and then the space expands.
What was before the Big Bang? Was there time?
A big crunch.
When nothing happened?
Was there time when nothing happened? I don't think there can be time when nothing happens.
I feel I've hit the wall.
The poor wall.
So what do you know? People ride around on their bicycles around and
yeah.
And they hit the wall. Well, I feel
like no. anyway, space.
Space is or it isn't. I can't quite understand the condition part.
Okay.
All emptiness is space.
All emptiness, right. You know what a Big Bang is?
Yes.
Right? So you crunch up the whole universe into one little point. Right? Which is smaller than even my sense of humour, okay?
Right?
Is that possible?
And what's outside? Is there any space outside of it?
Yes, lots. Because all the Big Bang is going to take up all that space.
So you think the space exists?
Yes.
Infinitely?
Yes.
And then this kind of moves into it, like there's a kind of...
Space and anything, it's just the concept.
Space is a concept.
How do you define space?
So how, just to come back to the Big Bang, you think that there's space outside of the little speck of dust?
Yes.
And how do you measure it?
Well, I have the speck of dust.
I don't know that I want to measure it.
How do you know that it's there? Do you step outside of that speck of dust?
I just assume it's there.
You assume that it's there, therefore it's there? This is like the one.
What is there then? What
well, this is like this is like the this is like the two economists walking through the jungle, and they fell into a tiger trap, plunged down to the bottom of this pit, and they look up and they've got no way of getting out. One of them says, "We're doomed. We're going to stay here until we die." The other one says, "No, hang on. First, we assume we have a ladder." So do we assume that the space exists? When they think in the Big Bang, nothing, there's nothing outside of that. See, that's very, we describe it as being very small. In fact, we can't really describe it in terms of dimensions because you can't fit a ruler in there, right? You can't actually measure it in any way. But you're just going to make various sort of guesses, really. And but there's nothing outside of it. Okay. That's the whole point. Not even a ray of light can escape from it. Yeah, it's all packed in. It's all packed. But there's nothing there to be empty. There's no way of measuring it or knowing that. Okay, there's no possible way of knowing that. It's all folded into it. But that's because you've got the piece of paper. You're assuming the piece of paper is given. Nothing is given, everything is folded in.
Because
yeah?
You have to ask, is nothingness emptiness? I think this is where he was getting caught up.
Yeah.
Nothingness equals emptiness.
Yeah.
Equals space, but that's not
true. Maybe there is nothing, maybe there is a lot of things, but we don't know. Because
you would never know.
The word space, what he's held between two objects.
Right.
That's what I take the word space to mean.
Yeah.
So...
If you look at the four immaterial, it gives you an indication of how the progression goes in terms of starting off with the concept of boundless space, and then that's superseded by the fact that there's nothing, and then there's something still perceiving the nothing, which is then consciousness, then neither perception nor non-perception. So if you have to let go of the concept of space, that means it's being overridden by something else. There's something greater than the concept of space or nothingness.
Or more subtle than that.
When they talk about the six elements, then one of them is space.
One of them is space, yeah.
And space defined as space in your ear holes and your nose and so on and so forth.
Mm.
So that must be in the space in your skin.
Limited space, yeah. Six. Okay, well, we'll leave it at that, Eva.
Oh, what
and
I have another.
Maybe you have to go over and stay with our Hindu friends and talk about the unconditioned nature of space.
I'll just watch you, and when you're in that jhana, I'll ask you more.
Okay, that's good. You do that, Eva. Go on.
So one conception of space means we get some kind of relationship with it, or that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other conception means we kind of just adapt ourselves to something that's just kind of there. So that's quite significant in terms of our relationship or non-relationship.
That's
what struck me in that simile of the daughter-in-law and her relationship with her father-in-law.
Right.
Like the ideal was that
there's
just this thing that is, his wishes, his desire, his social construction, and to be good, she just adapts herself to that.
Right.
Which kind of buys into that, or seems to be the same kind of paradigm as looking at space as unconditioned, seems to be a similar I've got my morning voice, can't talk till at least 12. But it seems to be a similar kind of...
Yeah. You know, I agree that the
problematic.
The elements are all defined in terms of each other.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and they're not defined as being things that exist objectively.
Right.
So it's when one element is disturbed, then the other ones are disturbed. Yeah.
So it's not one thing defining itself in terms of another.
Right.
But some kind of relationship between them and the two realities having an impact on each other.
Yeah. Which is what you can know.
Yeah. And so both.
So you can't.
Knowing is important.
Yeah.
Not and one person putting their knowing aside for the knowing or conceptions of another person.
Yeah.
Could you say more?
No. Well, I mean, I'm just trying to. There's this whole idea, I suppose, of a world or a system being taken as a given.
Mm-hmm.
Not something that's constructed, and so therefore it's something that you have a particular relationship that you should have, and so if you have a particular response, so that response is kind of invalidated because you need to adapt what kind of should be, and then there's another way of interacting which your response is kind of part of the reality, and you don't always push it away. And I mean, it's a delicate process, but it's two different kind of systems. And I'm just kind of wondering how that relates to this conception of space as a kind of conceptual thing.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's just a given, you know, the unconditioned that's kind of just there.
Yeah.
I can't quite connect it, but I just feel some kind of...
But it is why... You looked at it before, it's always bound up with like the contact, the feeling, the perception and so on. So it's like how you see these things. Yeah. So these things always arise within relationship. It's never talking about how they exist in and of themselves. And which is one of the great differences between the sutta presentation and often the Abhidhamma, especially later Abhidhamma presentation, which emphasized that these things, how they really, truly, really exist in and of themselves. So you've got this kind of world which exists in an absolute sense. Yeah. Whereas in here, it's always the four elements are always interacting, and then the mind is interacting with that. The internal and the external is always synthesizing. So it's always a movement towards synthesis. Yeah. Anyway, so in terms of Buddhist doctrinal history, then it would seem that anyway, the position of the suttas is fairly clear that space is conditioned, and is not unconditioned. Okay. Now we come to a very interesting little passage, and this is a unique passage in the suttas, and interestingly enough is not found in the Chinese, or the interesting bits of it are not found in the Chinese version, and one wonders if this is also associated with the early Abhidhamma developments. Ajati kancha vaso chakung aparibhinang hoti, when the eye internally is not cut off. Okay, so that means you've got an eye, basically. You're not blind, physically blind. Bahiracha rupa na apatang agachante. So external forms don't come within the range of the sight. So say you're staying in a pitch black place, there's nothing to be seen. No cha tajo samanaharo hoti. There's no appropriate sort of attention. So this is interpreted as being the same as manas. Manasikara is the turning of the mind towards it. You're not paying attention to the sight anyway, okay? So that can happen sometimes. You see that sometimes if you're meditating, and you can meditate, and as you're meditating, when your mind becomes focused inwards, sometimes your eyes can open. You can actually have your eyes be open, but you're not seeing anything that's outside them until something actually happens. So I remember that doing that in Perth, and you're sort of sitting there, meditate, and your eyes open, you don't realise that they're open. Sitting in front of a window, and then this kangaroo jumps past, right? And you're kind of startled, and you didn't realise your eyes are open. So there's no attention, there's no engaging with it, even though the eyes are there. Okay? Then there is not the manifestation, okay, of the appropriate vijnana bhaga, appropriate kind of consciousness, something like that.
section of consciousness, Bhikkhu Bodhi has translated it. Next clause, when the eye is internally unbroken, the bahiracha rupa, the forms do come into the sight, into the view, so you can actually see things, but there is no attention. So then this is still no appearance of the appropriate kind of consciousness. And when the eye is unbroken, the forms come within the range, and there is the appropriate act of attention. So the three factors. One is the internal, the physical internal sense base is working. Second factor is that there is an appropriate external sense object, and the third factor is that there's an appropriate, there's a suitable mental attention. Then there is the manifestation, patubhava, of the appropriate section of consciousness. Okay, so whatever in what has come to be, or what has been produced, or what has been conditioned by that, tathabhutasa rupang, that is included. Again, the word kasangahang in the rupa upadana kanda. Whatever in what has come to be is vedana. Whatever is conditioned by that is vedana, is in the is sangaha, in the vedana upadana kanda. Whatever is conditioned by that in the sanya, then that is in sanya, and sankhara is sankhara, and consciousness is consciousness. Okay? So again, the interdependence of all of these sort of things all arising together in one moment of awareness. Okay?
That's enormous, not to be taken in one moment.
Then, the material form in what has thus come to be, okay, is in, oh, where am I going? I just did that bit, no, sorry. Right. Blah, blah, blah. Thus, indeed, is how there comes to be the inclusion, okay, the coming, the gathering and the amassing. Again, three synonyms of the five aggregates. And this was spoken by the Blessed One. Yo! he said that all the time. I'll go put that in the list of the first things the Buddha did, the first thing in the suttas. The first, Buddha's first one to ever use the word yo. Yo paticca sammuppadang pasati. Who sees paticca sammuppada? Sees the Dhamma. Who sees the Dhamma? Sees dependent origination. Okay? So this is understood by the commentary in a somewhat narrow sense. Okay? Now it's a very pregnant phase. Interestingly enough, Sariputta is quoting from the Blessed One here, quoting from the Buddha, and yet we don't have any actual statement by the Buddha that actually says this. Okay? So he's quoting perhaps from a sutta which is non-existing anymore. All we have is Sariputta's quote. Whereabouts? No.
It's a bit strange.
That there's you, who sees me sees the Dhamma.
Who sees me sees the Dhamma, yeah.
There's another one.
Yeah, who sees
its
main origination. This is
a one
common one as well.
Gone.
This
Gone. Prove me wrong,
Dhamma
gone.
Dhamma or normal Dhamma? The
I doubt very much if it's Monday Jags or not. This is so the commentary understands this. There's one place in the Nidana Samyutta where it distinguishes paticca samuppada, okay, and the paticca samuppanna dhamma. So the paticca samuppada is the 12 links, like the relationship between these things. Paticca samuppanna dhamma are the actual dhammas arisen by dependent origination. So the ignorance, the sankharas, the consciousness, the nama rupa, and so on. These are the dhammas which are originated through dependent origination. And so this is how the commentary understands or explains this particular passage. It says that whoever sees the dhammas that are dependently originated sees the nature of the origination. Whoever sees the nature of the origination sees the things that have been originated. Okay?
Which makes sense.
It certainly makes sense.
It would seem to be something that the Buddha would say. This whole section looks like it's been cut and paste and stuck in after.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't recall in many suttas where Sariputta quotes the Buddha at all. He usually just gives a discourse.
Oh, no, he does. Yeah, he does.
That's quite characteristic.
That is quoted from the article, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that part of it is quite characteristic.
Why, are you saying that it's unusual to say one who sees dependent origination sees the Dharma?
Yes, it's the only place where it actually occurs.
Oh, okay.
Why don't we do a little search in the Burma Research Council edition?
You can, but it's not there.
It's not there.
You can search all you like. You can rewrite it if you want. Now, and of course, as a statement, this kind of philosophical statement does have other implications. You know, one, if you take Dhamma in its more broad sense, the Dhamma is the Buddha's teaching, then it means, you know, whoever sees the dependent origination is encompassing the whole of the Dhamma, yeah? And you see that, then you encompass the whole of the Dhamma. So this is like the capital D Dhamma. So it depends whether you interpret Dhamma as being small d Dhamma or big d Dhamma. The problem with the commentarial explanation is it says so Dhammang, it's a singular, whereas paticca samuppanna Dhamma is in plural, those things dependently originated. So perhaps it has a more pregnant sense there.
So, but really, if you do deeply experience dependent origination, you are actually seeing the essential Dharma. You're seeing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Particularly the Tibetan Mahayana, all their teaching is exactly in this statement.
Mm.
It's so central.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Yep.
The thing for me that makes more sense. And I know that you've covered this elsewhere, so I really look forward some time to hearing you teach about it, is to see dependent origination in one moment, in a series of moments of becoming, watching that becoming through clinging and grasping, and then see the dissolution.
Mm-hmm.
Then it feels like, yeah, that's the whole Dharma.
Okay.
That's one view of dependent origination.
Yeah. We could be here to the end of the year on that one.
We had 6 months of dependent origination class.
Yeah, these guys are sick of dependent origination.
We could do it again.
We could, yeah. Right. Now, moving right along, and the ear, same for the ear. Oops, lazy. Where are we going? Sees dependent origination, sees the Dhamma, and then says, what is the five aggregates are dependently originated, and whatever regarding these five aggregates is the desire and lust and holding on and so on. This is the origination of suffering. So here, coming back to the Four Noble Truths with which we started the whole sutta, and getting rid of these desire and lust and so on for the five aggregates is the ending of suffering, and then much has been done by the bhikkhu. So same for the ear and the nose and the tongue and the body, which is all relatively unproblematic. But then it comes to the interesting one, which is the mind. So when the mind is internally not cut off. So remember that the word mind or mano is used in the same sense here as eye or ear or nose is. So it's something like you have a physical basis for the sense. So some people translate mano here as brain, right? Which is not... There's something to it, but anyway. But and then the Dhammas don't come within the one's range, okay? So nothing comes within no Dhammas come within the range of the mind, okay?
Ajahn Brahm says that the brain is the vehicle for the mind. The mind uses the brain.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it?
But he also says that the mind can be completely independent of the brain.
This is one thing that I talked about as well, asking the forest teacher about about Manu and mind, so there's different terms used for mind, but it doesn't really make any difference for them. I think their pure mind still is something completely different from the things that's talked about the sutras.
Okay, so Ajati Koche Mano. So I'm not saying that Mano head means brain. I'm merely saying that it appears in some senses as being parallel, treated in a way that's parallel to the brain, and that's how it's been interpreted by some people. Bahiracha Dhamma Apatan. So Dhammas don't come in within the range. So in a sense, one's unconscious, one's not aware of anything. Tadjocha, and there's no appropriate act of attention. Okay, so there's no appropriate cast of consciousness. And then comes down the three options, and then finally, okay.
Three
convolutions. It's abbreviated on this particular version. Where are we now? On paragraph 37. Okay, so the three variations of this. So now all of these things come together, and then there is the manifestation of that appropriate class of consciousness. Now how this is interpreted by the commentary is that the mano aparibhinno is the bhavanga citta. Okay? So this is the stream of consciousness, okay, which is going on from moment by moment in an endless stream of moments of conscious activity, but which don't have any... there's nothing going on in there, okay? They simply is an event which, in a way, carries an imprint of memory and a karma and so on, but which isn't actually functioning in the sense of being aware. And so this is the mano, which is aparibhinno. And then when the Dhamma arises in it, so when there's something to stimulate that, then it comes out of that, and there's the appropriate act of attention, which is the manasikara. So this is what they call the citta vritti. So the 17 moments of consciousness is being analyzed in the Theravadan tradition. This is quite a unique analysis. And divides that up into very fine detail. And says there's the bhavanga, and then the bhavanga trembles, and has the shaking of the bhavanga, and then it's sort of turning around and then engaging with the object and determining the object and all of these kinds of different functions. So the citta exercises various kinds of functions depending on what place it takes in the citta vritti. And I think personally that the whole idea of the citta vritti is utterly incoherent from beginning to end and doesn't make any sense. So, yeah.
Can you say why?
I can.
In the screen.
Yeah. Right, during the bhavanga, yeah, there's nothing. It's just like a subliminal life, like all life continuum consciousness. Similar, it functions in a similar way. There's actually a passage in Vasubandhu where he talks about the alaya vijnana, and he says the alaya vijnana. He says the Theravadins call this bhavanga citta, and the Mahasanghikas call it the mula vijnana, the root consciousness. Okay, so Vasubandhu certainly thought that they're all the same thing. In a lot of Vasubandhu's treatise, he's actually arguing or addressing his treatise to the followers of the early schools. So if he was speaking to a Mahayanist, he would say, oh, it's the alaya vijnana. He wouldn't bother justifying it because he would just refer to the Mahayana sutras which talk about it. But because he's actually debating with non-Mahayanists, then he tries to use their own doctrines to say, well, actually, we're talking about the same thing.
Can I ask, has anyone ever experienced this kind of state?
The bhavanga?
Yeah.
Well, in the Thai forest tradition, there's always the bhavanga is always that kind of no mind, like really no mind. It's like, oh. And nothing happens, and you sit there and go, oh, God, what happens? Yeah. So it's like it's dreamless sleep is supposed to be like bhavanga, okay?
I've also heard interpretations in Burma where it's not without perception, that there is perception within that state. Certain images and certain nimitta can come up, for example, different dreamlike qualities. It's hard to know whether your state is conscious or unconscious of these particular phenomena as they arise and fall away.
Yeah.
That's what Ramya got in that dreadful retreat, and it took her months to get over it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's rubbish, but I think it's the Chittavitti is logically extremely incoherent from beginning to end. I wrote a book about a paper about it called The Mystique of the Abhidhamma, which I can show you sometime. But one of there's a number of reasons for it. One is because if you look at the Chittavitti, right, it's got this whole list of chittas, 17 chittas, which are supposed to perform various functions. So one of the functions of the chittas is supposed to be, for example, attention. So this is one that's mentioned here with the samanoharo, okay? So this is the function of attending. It's got to actually turn to an object. Fine, that's fine, right? But attention is not a chitta. Attention is a jetasika. So according to Abhidhamma analysis, chitta is, manasikara is one of the jetasikas, right? It's a function which is characteristic of associated with consciousness. So it's not something which a particular kind of consciousness does. It's something which is associated with consciousness in general. Okay, and so to say that there's one particular chitta which does that, well, effectively it's just a quality which the mind has, and any kind of chitta has it. So there's these kinds of incoherencies, where it's actually saying that the chittas are performing various kinds of functions, but those functions are actually functions of jetasikas, which are elsewhere described as being jetasikas, and that's not just in one place or another place. It's pervasive. Now, the other one is called the Javana Chitta, where Javana Chitta is the impulsion, and this is where you actually create karma. It's where you exercise intention or jetana. But again, intention is something which is associated with all different mind states. It's not something which is just exercised by some mind states and not by others. And so they're giving the chitta various kinds of functions which is supposed to do all these kinds of things. But none of those are the functions of chitta. The functions of chitta is to know. The function of chitta is knowing. Not acting or impulsing or turning or any of these things. The function of the chitta is to know, and the jetasikas are supposed to be doing all of these other things. Yeah. So this is. Yeah. So this is one of the problems with it. I mean, there's many others, but this is one of the very basic problems. Yeah. But there should be a printout of the Mystique of the Abhidhamma somewhere. We had some discussion about it some time ago. I was going to try and get it published as a book, but I never got around to it.
Basic chitta arising and falling, and when there's just the initial contact, that with consciousness, then all the other factors arise in the mind to respond to that contact.
Yeah, not necessarily. If we wanted to work with this model of the Bhavanga chitta. Okay, which would be the what appears, perhaps, this sutra is talking about by the Mano, or this is one interpretation of it, then the Bhavanga also has the other factors there, so it also has feeling and perception and sankharas and so on.
Every moment.
Every moment, they're all there, yeah, including the Bhavanga. Yeah, but they're there in a kind of late, they're not really doing anything, they're just kind of sitting around and having drinking tea and chatting, yeah. Yeah, but all kind of latent, which is the problem with the Bhavanga chitta is, again, chitta is supposed to be aware of stuff, but the Bhavanga chitta is not supposed to be aware of anything. So how this is actually meant to be interpreted is quite difficult, and this is the only place, everywhere else in the suttas, and it talks about consciousness, of course, the consciousness arises dependent on the various conditions, so it talks about actually acts of consciousness where you're aware of something. But here it seems to have this idea of this mano, as something which hasn't been cut off, and then somehow the thing arises in it, and it's sort of continuing, just in the same way that, say, the ear might continue when you're not actually hearing anything, okay? But the ear is still there. And that's the kind of the implication. So the interpretation of it is a little bit unclear. But certainly what we can say is that the sutta, if we are to take on its face value, doesn't tie us into any particular interpretive model of this. For example, you could interpret it as brain, you could interpret it as Bhavanga Chitta, you could interpret it as Alaya Vijnana, you could interpret it in a more basic sense of saying that one is still alive, one's still a sentient being, one's just been born and is someone who has a mind, right? And it's not any particular model that you've been committed to here. But it's model, but it's a saying which can be used and interpreted in various ways. Okay? So, then,
one sees.
Isn't it amazing? The whole sutta is really good until you come to verse 27, and then it becomes incomprehensible.
What about 26 about space? I don't think it's incomprehensible, but there are. I think it's interesting. The interesting things.
I think it's a good point. Good time to point out the Mahayana, that sutra that points out what the Abhidhamma people are doing. Do you remember that sutra?
Yeah, that's a great one. The Sandhi Niramochana Sutra. I'd have to get a copy. I'm not sure where it is, but that's a terrific one. So here we go. And that's it. So to this extent that much has been done by that bhikkhu or bhikkhuni. And the bhikkhus delighted in the Blessed One's words. Oh, so delighted in Venerable Sariputta's words. That's it. So this is a very, very, very profound sutta. We've only really scratched the surface. I mean, I have to apologize for these suttas that we do kind of... We should really take a few weeks to sort of linger on each one and explore them, but we're not going to, so there you go. You'll have to linger and explore them yourself. But often these things, they come more, you know, it's a matter of you have to kind of keep on going over them and gradually each time a little bit sinks in, and then you get a, like an apprehension of it, you get a feel for it.
Well, that's a good idea.
Hmm.
Have you got that book yet, Bhante? The book that should be used as a textbook by every single Buddhist person on the planet? You haven't done anything about it. See? Nothing.
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
Swift pair of messengers. Of course you do.
Swift pair of messengers.
You've got stacks and stacks of another book.
Mm.
But what you actually need is stacks and stacks of this one.
Mm.
Everyone who comes here should go away with one. Yeah. These are all people interested in Buddhism. Then they would find out what it is they're interested in.
That would be good.
Apart from Buddha and the rose apple tree and stuff.
Yeah, thank you for your interest, Eva. It would be good to reprint it sometime. But
you said you would.
Well, if you want to organise it, I'll be very happy.
He never said that.
Is this the first, because they've missed some, is this the first sutra that talks about the elements in this way?
I think so, yeah. The first one talks about in detail. I think there's a few others, but that's about it, yeah.
When we say that when eyes and tap and no external form comes, when external forms come into the range, but there's no corresponding engagement.
Yeah.
They're saying that because you are mindful. Is that what they're saying? Because you're mindful, you're not.
No. It's not. It just means that there's no. You're just not watching.
Because you're doing something else?
Yeah.
So
this is, you know, this is like the couple of sitting there watching TV and they don't notice that the people are stealing their things behind them.
Well, but I feel a little confused why are they spending so much time saying that?
Yeah, look, I'm also... I couldn't say 100%. I mean, it takes so much time. It's the only place in the suttas where this is discussed in this way.
Uh-huh.
So, where?
Is it dependent origination where it gives the... With the presence of three things, there is, for example, eye consciousness and form and the sense base of eye. Then there is contact.
You worry about where's the consciousness coming?
I'm just like, here you're talking about, you know, one of the aggregates and about dukkha, and then you have these paragraphs about there's no engagement, and it would make sense if there's no engagement because you're mindful, which I know isn't exactly what they're saying.
Yeah, no, that's not what it means. Yeah. No, it doesn't mean engagement in the sense of getting involved in something. Engagement is just the word that he's using instead of attention.
Okay.
because attention is taken up by manasikara.
Okay.
Okay. So, but it doesn't mean engagement in that sense. Yeah. Yeah. Hanga doesn't give much on that end passage, but the Chinese. The Chinese doesn't have that particular passage, so it's kind of, it is suggestive of that particular emphasis on sort of analytical presentation of consciousness, which is very characteristic of the Pali school. So one wonders, you know, we've seen throughout that there are these linguistic connections with the Abhidhamma, and so one wonders whether this is a particular development of the Pali school.
Okay.
The 17 teachers were wonderful. You told me that.
Yeah.
Do the other Abhidhammas have that?
No. That's the Bhavanga, the Chittaviti, and all of that stuff is peculiar to the
Theravada
school. The other Abhidhammas have like the distinction into Chitta and Jetasika, which they call Chitta and Jaita. They don't include, so, and then they analyze that in various ways, yeah, but they don't have that very kind of exact development of the process of consciousness, which the that's just a Pali kind of thing, and quite a late Pali thing. There's not even much about it in the Visuddhimagga. I mean, it's kind of referred to and described a bit in the Visuddhimagga, but it's not like a major theme of the Visuddhimagga by any means, and it's very much in the later texts that became.
And the Abhidhammas of other schools have authors.
The Abhidhamma text, the canonical Abhidhamma text, is given authors, yes.
But Theravada school is the Buddha comes down and blah blah blah.
Yeah, Theravada claimed that there was the Buddha himself spoke at the other schools, except that it was spoken by
some monk.
One of other disciples, yeah.